This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 7, Episode 4 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today is the fourth part in our series on Simon Pegg, looking at his work as a writer. And we're going to be talking about his third screenplay, which is Run, Fat Boy, Run.
Indeed.
This is a movie which came out, I guess it came out in the UK in 2007, but it came out in the US in 2008.
Yeah, it was like March of 2008, I think.
It was written initially by Michael Ian Black and then rewritten by Simon Pegg and directed by David Schwimmer. Simon Pegg stars along with Tandy Newton and Dylan Moran, I think is how you pronounce the guy's name.
Yeah, I think so.
And Hank Azaria. And it is, it's came out in 2008, as we said. So would you want to give a
sure, why not?
Synopsis?
Guy leaves his beautiful pregnant fiance on the wedding day, runs away from the wedding, goes into a lifetime of just sort of like a pathetic life. He's almost sort of an Al Bundy character. Like he's working as a security guard, but it's very much an Al Bundy vibe. And he's irresponsible and he isn't leading a particularly good life, but then he snaps out of it because his former fiance is now cozied up with Hank Azaria's wealthy and successful and intelligent character who wants to whisk her and his son away. And so he buckles down and he says he's going to run it's not the London Marathon because they couldn't get the rights. It's the Nike River Run or something like that.
Yeah.
And so that's a marathon that he's going to run in to prove that he can see something to the finish. And that's the premise of the movie.
Exactly. It's very similar in a lot of ways thematically to Pegg's other movies. You know, the sort of man-child who has never grown up, and you know, everyone else in his life has moved on, and he's getting left behind, and he decides that it's time to take a stand for what's right and step up to the occasion, step up to the streets, and you know, do this thing, become an adult.
Yes, by training for and running in a marathon in 3 weeks, which I can assure anybody listening is not possible. Maybe with the way the movie ends, spoiler alert, he doesn't die. Maybe with how long it takes the task to be completed in the movie, okay, I'll buy it. But yeah, no, you're not going to like post. How spoiler-driven do we want to be? Because I want to get right to the thing that absolutely drove me nuts.
Okay, let's just say right here, if you haven't seen Run, Fat Boy, Run, we're going to spoil it.
Yes,
let's just say before that, though, I guess, not to dissuade anyone from watching the movie, but spoilers, it's not very good.
That's true. Okay. That is the ultimate, that's a very key spoiler to give right there, I would say.
So that way you don't have to worry about like not listening to this if you were on the fence and thought that maybe this was like cinema gold or something, or fried gold, as they might say.
Well, this, you know what? This is not like Psycho where we were like, stop what you're doing and go and watch it. Just keep listening. We're good.
Yeah, listening. Yeah. You'll know exactly what happens in this movie as soon as you start it. So anyway.
So he completes the marathon in I forget what the time is, but it's like 12 hours and something minutes or whatever. And the fact that I'm nitpicking it, I think, is more a testament to the fact that the movie, I had absolutely zero investment in it by the end. But they have like cutoff times for marathons and everything. So they're sitting here forcing this feel good story and everything. And I'm so just intellectually not invested in anything that's going on. It's driving me nuts because I'm like, no, they would have closed down the course and kicked him off by this point. Like they wouldn't let him continue going on. Like it's not possible for this ending to exist. And that bothers me. But the thing is, if I'd enjoyed the movie a great deal up to that point, that gets forgiven. And I'm like, that's not how real life is. But the fact that I didn't enjoy the movie up to that point, I'm sitting there through the whole sequence that's supposed to be moving me, that's supposed to be me cheering him on and saying, yeah, right, he's not going to give up. And instead I'm sitting there saying, this is malarkey. This doesn't happen.
You know, okay, I think that this is sort of here's a middle ground, which, you know, you might be able to accept it on, okay? They would have shut down the race and everything like that, I mean, it's still kind of like a public street, you know? I mean, they're not going to kick him off. And I don't know, I keep on thinking there's this story, which, well, I never actually read the article, but, you know Mitch Albom, the guy... Yeah. He wrote Tuesdays with Maury and...
Yeah, Five People You Meet in Heaven.
And he also, his day job at least was, he was a sports writer for the Detroit Free Press, I think.
Yeah.
And I heard an interview with him one time, and he was talking about how he was covering the Olympics, and it was like a track and field, race or whatever. Okay. And there was a guy who tripped and fell... And, messed up his leg, whatever, could barely walk, right?
Yeah.
And, it was a short distance race, on the track. And, they run, people fall all the time, whatever. It's like, oh, that guy fell. He wasn't like a contender or anything, really, And everyone sort of went on with their lives, and he, is writing down his stuff for that, whatever sports journalists do. And then he looks over and he sees this guy on the track after pretty much everyone has cleared off. And there's an older guy who he has his arm around, and they're walking to the finish line. And okay. He crosses the finish line and then, mm-hmm. Leaves or whatever. So he's like, okay, what the hell just happened there? There's the story. Let me go track this guy down. And it turns out mm-hmm. that, it was his dad. And when his dad saw what happened, he was like, okay, this guy has spent his entire life, my son has spent his entire life training for this race. He needs to finish. And he, came down out of the stands or wherever he was and did it so that his son could say that he finished. Okay. Now, I don't think that technically counts. I don't know, because then again, he was saying that the reason why he did it was because if you are disqualified, you're not in the record books or something in the Olympics. But
I have no idea.
But then again, I don't know. I'm guessing it's against the rules to have someone help you across.
I know Olympics rules even less than I know marathon rules, but I can tell you that you mentioned, it's public roads and everything. Yeah, they shut down things because you're running the wrong way on roads and stuff like that. And so just listen, I know it's a silly thing for me to fixate on. So I'm going to walk away. I'm just going to be like, I'm just sort of harping on it as an example of how little I cared by the time the movie ended.
No, I mean, I definitely know what you're talking about. And certainly, that happens to me all the freaking time in movies. I think everyone does that. When you know something about something, you're like, well, why? This doesn't make any sense. This is completely illogical. Like Planet Terror and Death Proof, the film damage in those movies has absolutely no correlation to any sort of film damage in the real world. It drives me up the wall,
And it should. I will learn to walk past it by saying I watched that god awful remake of Day of the Condor with Bruce Willis and Richard Gere.
Day of the Jackal.
I'm sorry. The remake of Day of the Jackal
was called The Jackal, I think.
Yes. And that the ending of that happens in D.C. and the metro system that they run down to doesn't even have a passing resemblance to the D.C. metro. So
yeah,
in terms of suspension of disbelief, it's not as bad as that. So,
yeah.
Just if I had liked it more, but I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that I'm sitting here, I'm hammering on the movie. What was your reaction to the film?
You know, when I first saw it, because I first saw it when it came out, I was a projectionist at the time, complaining about, this would have been right around the time, because it had been about a year, so I was still complaining about the film damage and Planet Terror and Death Proof, and, you know, everyone was a Simon Pegg fan, you know, because of the movies that we just watched.
Yeah.
And the idea that he had a new movie coming out, which looked like a cheesy romantic comedy, sort of was secondary next to the fact that not only was he starring in it and he's a funny guy, but also that he had a hand in writing the script. Mm-hmm. So we were all super excited, and we all, you know, watched it, you know, me and my coworkers, we all watched it when the print came in, you know, because we needed to screen it anyway to make sure that there wasn't anything wrong with it, make sure it didn't have any Planet Terror-like film damage. you know, we were excited to watch it. And
sure.
I came out of it thinking, like, well, it is a formulaic romantic comedy, but that's okay. You know, it worked for what it was. I'm, you know, not going to rush out and see it again, but I enjoyed watching it. So now, this is, about 7 years later? This is the first time I have seen it since then, mm-hmm. and it did not work for me nearly as well as it did back then, which wasn't
okay.
a whole lot. The thing that struck me more than anything was, yeah, that the plot is paint by numbers and, you know, all that stuff, and that's fine. But to me, the humor was the big problem. The jokes
yes.
fall so flat, and there's, it's
yes.
so over the top and just almost like, you know, childish humor, you know? I mean, like, there's literally fart jokes in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's just like, none of this is funny. And I mean, it's not even like they tell a joke and you're like, that's not funny. Like, they go for it and they fail
yes.
on a grand scale.
They do. The only time they got a smirk out of me was the locker room scene between him and Hank Azaria.
Yeah.
And that is because anybody... can relate to the idea of being in, you know, guys can relate to the idea of being in a locker room and somebody failing to have any sense of decorum about how they appear in those moments.
Yeah.
And that moment was captured and it was kind of like, but that was about the most humor in the entire film for me.
Yeah. And it starts yeah. off, I mean, like from the very first scene, like I'm watching it and I've got like my 7.1 sound system here, and I've got it turned up because the volume was rather low, and then he starts banging his head on the floor because he's
yes.
like very upset that he's gonna have to get married right now and he's not ready for this
to an extremely beautiful woman
yeah,
who
Tandy
apparently
Newton.
Adores him
yeah
so
yeah.
there you go yeah.
but he's scared, you know, because he's scared to grow up, right? And he's like banging his head on the floor, and it was so loud. It sounded like, you know, something out of the Matrix, you know? And then they have the little visual cue where they're like looking up. The people below him are looking up
yep.
at the ceiling because he's apparently banging his head so hard on the floor, even though that doesn't register when you actually see him do it. And you actually see like little like plaster dust fall mm-hmm. from the ceiling onto this guy's shoulder. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
Come on, is this a cartoon? Like, is this
right.
straight up a cartoon?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right that there are points where it goes over the top. And what's funny is I don't know specifically who wrote what or how much of a rewrite it was or whether he just tweaked certain scenes. But there were certain moments where it felt like he was trying to be... Nick Frost
mm-hmm.
instead of Simon Pegg, you know, because he, in the two movies previous to this, he plays the straight man basically.
Yeah.
But then in this, it feels like they're putting him into the funny man role, and it feels, it doesn't feel natural. It feels forced. And also, you know, with him doing Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, I almost wonder if that really worked, him having his name on the script really works against him or the movie as a whole. Because like you said, you look at it, it's like, oh, that looks like a formulaic romantic comedy. Maybe there's almost like a subconscious expectation of, well, it's a formulaic romantic comedy, but it's been given a twist by Simon Pegg, because I've seen his previous work and I know what he does with genres, and he's going to somehow turn this on its head. And there's no turning of the head, turning anything on its head. There's just, like you said, amping up the bits so that when he's banging his head, the plaster dust falls. And, you know, the weird chasing the shoplifter sequence is just, it's just bizarre. I mean, you want to talk about like a quote unquote comedy bit where it's like, you don't even, and you know, I'll say also that the movie's in trouble right from the get go when the shoplifter is calling him fat and he's saying, I'm not fat, I'm unfit. And I'm looking at him in his costume and I'm like, yeah, I don't get why this is called Run Fat Boy Run. Like, maybe there's a little bit of paunch going on of like that anybody, you know, like an average person who's not particularly, you know, like blasting at the gym all the time is going to have. But like, you know, I don't see the justification for the title in the way that he looks. Like, he doesn't even look substantially different from when he ran. Like, if they had shown that, like, he runs from the wedding and then he really falls off the wagon and he's drinking all the time and he's, you know, got like a big beer belly or something like that, whether it's a prosthetic or not, you know, like, there's nothing to signify why the title is even that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he did, I guess he did have a bit of a prosthetic in at least some scenes in the movie, but like, I remember, I can't remember the exact timing, but I'm pretty sure that he was like shooting this movie or it was just about to come out when they were doing that Hot Fuzzival, you know, and I saw him like in person and he's like, I'm going to be in this movie, Run Fat Boy Run. And I'm looking at him and I'm like, you are the skinniest person on the face of the earth. Like, he is a little tiny guy, you know? And right. I'm like, well, how are you doing that? I read an interview which is touching on a lot of things that we are kind of speculating on here with the mm-hmm. other writer of the movie, Michael Ian Black. And, you know, in that, he does say, like, you know, they're like, okay, so they cast Simon Pegg and he's not fat. So what's the deal? And he's like, well, I never meant it to be like someone who was like morbidly obese or anything like that. It was supposed to be someone who was kind of out of shape, you know, and that's like a taunt which is thrown at him, you know, which yeah. may or may not have, you know. You know, I mean, pretty much, you know, the way that Simon Pegg responds, it's, you know, he's right. You know, he's like, I'm not. Yeah. Fat, I'm just out of shape, you know. And
yeah,
but they were like, they actually asked Michael Ian Black in that interview, like, who did you see like in the role? And he's like, well, you know, I guess the number one casting choice would have been Jack Black. And he's like, the other person I thought of who would be really good would be Philip Seymour Hoffman. So that was what he was envisioning okay. when he was writing it, was like Jack
and I could
Black.
See that sort of build.
Yeah, yeah.
Working a lot better for the film. Now, when Michael Ian Black wrote it, I think it was originally written for the Los Angeles Marathon, UK production company grabbed it, right?
Yeah, I read that too. I think that was wrong. I think it was originally written for New York. Because in this interview, he said the only four cities which he could see it being in were New York, Boston, Chicago, or London, because those are like the four big cities that have mm-hmm. big marathons.
Which
so,
in and of itself is funny, because you have to qualify to run in those marathons. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to run a marathon and then get a low enough time to qualify for the marathon to begin. I don't know if that's the rules in London, but I know in New York and I know Boston, you definitely have to qualify.
Yeah.
And I think New York you do as well.
No, yeah, I think you're right, because I remember I worked with a guy who was racing in like another race in order to try to qualify mm-hmm. for one of those, Boston or New York. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's why the Marine Corps Marathon's always been called the People's Marathon, because they're like, you know what? They give you like lenient times, and they're like, you know what? Do it. Just make your way across the finish line, and that's the one I ran. Like, and that's why.
So you actually, because I knew that you've done the tough mutter things. I didn't realize that you actually ran a marathon.
Yes, ran on my. It was precisely to the day on my 1 year wedding anniversary. My wife and I ran it.
Oh wow!
Together.
Wow.
Yeah, we crossed that finish line hand in hand. I would not leave her side. And it was actually her idea. She wanted to do it.
You wouldn't leave her side, or she wouldn't leave your side?
I wouldn't leave her side.
Oh, okay.
I'm not, the thing is, I'm not like trying to like puff myself up here, but like there were various points where, like when we were in training and everything, she's like, you can run faster than I can. I'm like, no, the point of this is we're doing it together. It's a whole thing.
Yeah,
but
that's cool.
But like with the Marine Corps Marathon, their whole thing is they don't, you know, there are people who run it to win it, and they run it for qualifying times and everything, but that is not that's not the gist of it. They're like, they don't care if you jog the thing. They don't care if you can walk it fast enough, knock yourself out. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sorry to, you know, it's just that I know that the other marathons, I remember while we were training, they were like, oh, no, you have to qualify and get less than, you know, was it like 4 hours to run the Boston Marathon after running this one? It's like, what, seriously? And they're like, yeah. It's like, wow, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's a pretty fast race right there. I don't know.
26.2 miles is a lot longer than you even think it is. Really is.
No, that was like the one thing in the movie where I'm like, I thought they did like extremely well, where they like really build it up. Like, look at him. He's done such an amazing job. And he's like, I don't know how much longer I can go. How much longer do I have? And he's like, oh, nothing. It's just, you know, 9 miles. And he's like, what?
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Cool. I will never run one again, though. I ran one and I'm done. I've done many other crazy things, but I'll never do that again. I think it's just awful. But yeah, actually, you know what? I will give them credit that it is funny when his friend is there by his side and he's like, oh, you just got 9 more miles to go. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's impressive for sure. Yeah. Well, looking at, you know, kind of like what it was that Simon Pegg did do, you know, this mm-hmm. Michael Ian Black interview that I read was kind of very telling in a lot of ways. Now, you sent me like a message after watching it saying like, I need to look into what's going on because, you know, you hear Simon Pegg rewrote someone and your first thought is like, well, then how good could it really be? You know, yeah. He's working with someone, he's fixing something that had a problem maybe, you know, who is this other writer, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And, you know, that was kind of the impression that I left you with, I think. And then you said, like, you know, something to the effect of, I didn't realize that he was rewriting Michael Ian Black. You know, if that's usually a combination for success in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So I'm not that familiar with Michael Ian Black, honestly.
He's very funny. I don't even remember how I figured out who he was, or I saw him appear somewhere, and I used to follow him on Twitter and everything, but the guy is just, he's whip smart funny. So mm-hmm. like seeing his name attached to it, I mean, it's surprising enough seeing Simon Pegg's name attached to it and not getting a laugh out of it. But then seeing Michael Ian Black, like the guy, you know what? Michael Ian Black, he's probably most famous, unfortunately, for constantly appearing on those VH1. I love the 90s. I remember the night. You remember those things?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was on those all the time. It was like him and Patrice O'Neill were the two regulars. And he was hysterically funny in those things. I think that's how I actually discovered who he was. So, again, seeing his name on it, I would have figured, even if the movie stank on ice, I would have expected with these two names for the dialogue to have been like, you know what? It was a crappy movie, but there were some really funny exchanges between people.
Yeah.
You know? And that wasn't there.
Yeah. In this interview, he talked about, you know, which he did this to promote the movie, you know, and they said, okay, you know, well, what was the deal? You know, you originally wrote it, you know, it was going to be set in America, you know, and he was saying that, yeah, it was originally supposed to be in America, in New York or whatever, which I think is where he's from. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it, and this says a lot, honestly. He said that he had been doing like a lot of weird sort of indie things at the time. And more as a writing exercise than anything else, he wanted to try to write something formulaic, something which was like a safe studio picture. And he was like, okay, romantic comedy, that's good. You know, what's a, like, what's a funny scenario? And he's like, opposites, you know, like, you know, a fat guy running a marathon, you know, it's the juxtaposition there. That seems like it's good, you know, run, fat boy, run. That's where he came up with the thing. And he set out to make it, you know, mainstream. And he said that when he finished writing it or whatever, you know, his goal, he had one of two goals. One would be to direct it himself, and the other one would be to sell it to a studio for a ton of money. And he said he didn't either. He sold it to a studio for a little bit of money. but he sold it to, yeah, a British studio. And, you know, then they, you know, Britishized it with, you know, Simon Pegg became involved. David Schwimmer, who's actually, I think, from Chicago as well, he became involved. And as the director, and they, you know, Simon Pegg came on to star in it, and then he rewrote it. And basically his big contribution to it was that he, you know, Anglo-fied it or whatever.
So he made it so that like his interactions within the city of London made sense.
Right.
Okay.
He gave it that sort of more British sense of humor, I think, in a lot of ways. I don't know. I mean, that sort of thing. You know, Black said that the story is almost identical to what he had written. Mm-hmm. He said that very few things had changed. One of the things that he mentioned was the Indian landlord with the daughter.
Yes.
In Black's script, it was an Italian landlord with a much younger wife. So, I mean, that's not a big change at all. You know,
the way that Black had it is more of that sort of New York stereotypical trope than
right.
And so so Peg just turns it into the London version of that.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You know, I mean, that's the type of thing that he was doing. You know,
okay.
He said that the ending was a little bit different too. But Black also said that he thought that the changes that that Peg made were for the better. He said that he thought that the ending was improved, and he thought that the jokes were funnier. And he was very complimentary of Peg. And he, you know, when the interviewer was asking him, like, what did you think about a skinny guy like Peg being cast in the lead? And he's like, oh, I thought it was great because he's a really good actor and a really funny guy, you know? It was weird because, like, he basically said, you know, they were like, were you involved at all, you know? And he said, no, I wasn't. I went to the set for a week, you know, just to say, hey, and then, you know, walked away. But they all did their thing and without me. And, he, you know, they kept on sort of, like, asking him, like, are you happy with it? Did it turn out the way you wanted to and everything? And he was very complimentary of everything that was done and saying, yes, it turned out as well as I could have expected. It's, you know, very happy with the finished product. Yeah. And then the very last question is, now that you've had this experience and it's been a positive experience, are you more open to the idea of writing things and then selling them and letting someone else, you know, make movies based on your original ideas? And his response was, no, this experience made me not want to do that. I don't want to write something, sell it to someone, and then come and sit in a hotel room 4 years later and talk about, you know, this movie that's coming out. I want to be there for the whole process.
Okay.
So that
is
interesting.
pretty telling.
It is kind of telling, yeah. Especially since like he was doing. I mean, this was, you know, part of like the press tour, I guess, for this movie. You know,
yeah.
So I mean, he's not going to throw them under the bus, you know. But reading it, I really did get the impression that he did like the finished product, you know. But perhaps it wasn't exactly the way that he would have done it, even though he was sure. happy with it. Even if he thinks it was better than what he would have done, I don't think that it's what he would have done.
Okay.
But
yeah, that sounds fair. I mean, I do think it's funny if he's giving the whole interview. Oh yeah, no, it's great. These changes are wonderful. Let's go. Oh yeah, no, I liked all the choices they made. Would you do it again? Nope, not at all.
yeah.
That is pretty telling.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it is interesting, too. I mean, I think that might be part of the whole experience, you know, from going back to the beginning of this project for him, where he said, I want to make a studio film, you know, and that's part of the process is, you know, sometimes letting go and letting the studio make the studio film, you know. I don't know.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, so that interview, I mean, I think is sort of telling as to what Simon Pegg did with this. And, you know, those things that to me, I mean, yes, Simon Pegg's movies are very funny. He's a very funny guy and, you know, he's good at one-liners and whatnot. But to me, like you look at Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, and from a writing perspective, what I see as being like really standout about it is how they work on a conceptual level, how they work like structurally and all this stuff. And it's almost like you could do all of that groundwork, hand the outline to someone else and they could write the dialogue and it would almost be, you know, the same thing. You'd still see that brilliance coming through. Whereas here the opposite occurs, and while Simon Pegg is good at telling jokes, it's not you're not getting the full Pegg. You're only getting half a Pegg.
Only
if that makes any sense.
Only getting half. You know what? See, the thing is now, if Star Trek Beyond goes sideways in any way, you've planted that line in my brain. And I'm like, I only got half a Pegg, and I'm just going to trot that out. If I don't like Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah.
So I didn't see any interviews speaking to this specifically, but did you find anything about, you know, why Pegg agreed to do this? Was this just, okay, I've made it and they've driven a dump truck of cash up to my front door and they want me to do this. So, okay, I'm a star now. So sure. Was this, they cajole him in some way? You know, like I didn't find anything where that really gave real insight as to why he agreed to do his part with this.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know. I mean, you know, he looking at, you know, some of the other stuff that he has written, he's done some things like, you know, writing English language adaptations of, you know, foreign animated movies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's done that sort of thing before. So, I mean, I just... I don't know. I mean, to me, I think it could have been that, you know, it could have been that he thought that this was, you know, kind of interesting, or it could have been, I think this is probably most likely that, you know, he read the script and was like, that's good, and agreed to sign on to do the movie. And then they said like, well, we need to change some things. And he's like, oh, well, I'll do that, you know, which is kind of similar, yeah. I think, to what's going on with Star Trek, you know, where... I mean,
that's
like
a great point, actually.
We
you're right.
I mean, he's told the story, and I think we've probably told it here where,
yeah.
you know, he was on the set of Mission Impossible 5? Is it 5 now?
Yeah, 5. Yeah. Rogue Nation was 5.
Yeah, he's on the set of Mission Impossible 5 while all of the writing turmoil was going on and director turmoil and stuff. And Brian Burke, who's the producer of both, is there talking to him about it. I'm assuming both as a collaborator and as a fan and as someone who knows how to write stuff, you know? And yeah. Simon Pegg is like, well, what you should do is this. What you should do is this. And Brian Burke says, yeah, how about you do this? You got all these great ideas. Why don't you just write it for us? And he's like, why? Sure. You know?
But I, you know, I almost get a sense though that the difference is that he came in and he, I don't know, polished. He, you know, he didn't totally blow up Black's script.
Yeah.
He reworked parts of it. Whereas, and I mean, I don't know this for sure, but like, haven't they done sort of a took it back to the bones and then rebuilt it again for Beyond, didn't they?
Yeah, I was under the impression that it was a page one rewrite, you know. Okay. Well, not even rewrite, just a new story, you know, a completely new thing that doesn't have anything to do with the other thing, you know?
Yeah.
But then again, I don't know, because IMAX just released a press release a couple days ago saying that Star Trek Beyond is going to be in IMAX, which everyone knew because that's why they moved the release day, was to clear open and get it into IMAX screens. But in that press release, they list the writers as Roberto Orci, J.D. Payne, and Patrick McKay, and Simon Pegg and Doug Young. So that to me, I mean, who knows? Obviously, it's not final, and maybe the press release is going off of old data, although since it is like a Bad Robot, like Paramount, IMAX, you'd think that they'd get the credits, right? Maybe it's a contractual thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they're still officially crediting the writers of the last script. So who knows?
Yeah, but Jack B. Soward's got that credit for Star Trek II.
Well, you know, and, I don't know. Because I asked John Tenuto about that because he's read like every single draft of Star Trek II, literally. You know, and I'm like, how would you credit it? You know, if you were in charge of the arbitration or whatever, what would you do? And he's like, well, I'd probably do like story by Harve Bennett and Jack B. Soward's, screenplay by Nicholas Meyer and Jack B. Soward's. So he deserves credit on Star Trek II. It's just that Nicholas Meyer probably does too. Definitely does too.
I'd say Nick Meyer had something to do with how good everything was. Yeah.
Yeah. Good, like Meyer is the one who put it all together, like the stuff that he was putting together, like a lot of the stuff in that script was, you know, Soward's. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, okay. But maybe it's that. Maybe
it
the
could be.
Maybe the whatever planet killing weapon or whatever that they're dealing with was from the original script and they just rewrote everything around it.
That could be. I mean, it happened with, I think it was a Star Trek 4 or Star Trek 6, one of those where there were a couple young kids who came in and, you know, did some work on it and then they threw out their draft, but they're still, you know, credited. I mean, that stuff happens all the time. But who knows? But yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I kind of have a feeling that that's what's happening with Michael Arndt being credited on the episode 7 screenplay. By the way.
Yeah, you know, I'll be very interested. It'll take a long time for that to get shaken out.
Yeah,
but, I'll be very interested to find out exactly because there's no way they're going to keep that completely under wraps. They can't. I mean, I don't think that they would keep it under wraps in a bad way or that it's necessarily anything bad. But I suspect that when we get a commentary.
Yeah.
From Abrams, you know, on the Blu-ray or whatever. He'd be like, okay, so, you know, here's what we did when we came in. So, and maybe we'll get that as well as part of the eventual presser or Blu-ray or whatever from Peg when Star Trek Beyond has been out.
Yeah, yeah. Sooner or later, all of these stories will come out. It might take a few decades, but we'll hear them all eventually.
Here's hoping it's all in the retrospect of thinking about, oh, what went so right with these movies?
Yeah, how they overcame such adversity in filmmaking to make this masterpiece. Much like Star Trek II, right? You know?
Yeah.
Instead of like the Star Trek Insurrection thing, which...
yeah.
It's hilarious because, like, you know, we've been talking to some people and everything, and we're like, oh, yeah, well, we'd love to have you back on the show to talk about whatever. And, like, three people now have been like, have you done anything on Insurrection yet? And I'm like, sort of, you know? Everyone wants to talk about Insurrection because I think they want to talk about, like, how it all fell apart, you know?
Yeah. And,
which is really interesting. There's a book about it, you know what I mean? Which is cool. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's not an official book yet.
Yes, yes.
But it will be. It will be.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
So, okay, so that's that. Any final thoughts on?
You know what? I will say that I haven't left a review for Run Fat Boy Run. I've toyed with the idea because I still love the fact that Festival in Cannes, this guy right here, I still have the only review on there. But I wasn't moved to quite the same level of outraged waste of time that moved me to. So, you know what, though? I'm not going to bother trying to look for the positive. Don't bother seeing this movie. I'm sorry. You will just regret that hour and 44 minutes gone from your life.
To me, it's not horrible. It's just bad. You know, I watch a lot of movies, a lot of them against my will. You know, it's just sort of the nature of things. And I've seen a lot of really bad movies. And this is definitely not one of those. This is definitely just a not very good movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah.
It's not a reason to see it, but if you do happen to see it somewhere along the way, you won't flip out and shoot your television.
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
No, it's just one of those movies that you watch and go like, they didn't quite make that one work, you know? It's a very average movie. I would say that this is at about the quality level of most movies.
Hmm.
Maybe not most movies that you watch. Certainly not most movies you try to watch. But
I see. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
It is definitely about the average movie level.
Sure.
In terms of quality. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Run, Fat Boy, Run today. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They just happened to come at just the right time.
Right,
or just
the wrong
time
for it to be dangerous.
Like, literally, like, not even like that day, but like 2 minutes before this happens.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
The Ready Room.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
Yeah. To the Journey.
Okay, I know Tristan's gonna pick that one, and he's gonna pick that one, so I'm gonna pick this one.
Yeah, this one has a really nice Bellana moment, so I'm gonna leave that one for Tristan.
Right, like, of course you pick it every time, and I know I can rely on you.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Now I feel like I have to see The Wicker Man to get all of the jokes that are in this movie.
Which one, the original or the remake?
Why would I watch anything with Nicolas Cage?
The 602 Club.
I remember hearing Timothy Zahn, even back then, reading an article that he was listening to the John Williams scores in his car. As he was thinking all this through and making sure the pacing felt like it did with the music. So maybe it had to do with the certain music he was listening to. Maybe he was listening to a New Hope score at that point. I don't know.
Literary Treks.
I think we had between the three of us half a dozen or eight different springboards. And they were written in such a way that they could have gone to either ship and crew. It was like, you know, the Sagittarius encounters big blob in space, or Endeavor encounters derelict spacecraft. Or, I mean, I'm being real surface here. I mean, the prompts we provided in the Bible were probably just a couple of sentences long, and it was just meant to say these are the kinds of stories we're thinking about.
Women at Warp.
So we went in and pitched, and I have to say that was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I have scrubbed in on brain surgery. It did not frighten me as much as waiting outside Gene Roddenberry's office getting ready to go in and pitch to him.
Meta Treks.
That would have just been a grand moment if, you know, George Takei would have played Tuvix, you know, and when the transporter accident happens, he's standing there in those colorful clothes and just says, "Oh my.
Oh my."
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you want to help us out and, you know, do some Christmas shopping at the same time, you can go to the Trek FM store on Redbubble and, you know, buy some cool merch.
Yeah, a lot of cool merch. There's a lot of great stuff on there.
Yeah, I'm wearing some of it right now. I've got my Trek FM hoodie on.
Represent.
It's actually very comfortable. The printing on it is very good.
It's a high-quality garment.
It is. You know, sometimes, you know, you kind of have to wonder about these, you know, like made-to-order things, and it's like, what am I getting? I'm extremely impressed by. It is very nice and warm. I'm in Chicago where, you know, even though it's mid-November, it's snowing like crazy and, you know, all nasty.
Envious. I'm envious of the snow. I'm not going to lie.
I loved the snow before I started driving, and now I hate the snow.
But see, the snow, if it were that cold, it would be a wonderful excuse for me to wear my Trek FM sweatshirt.
There you go.
You know, that's why I want the cold weather to show up.
But if you're not in a cold climate, you can get a Trek FM t-shirt.
That's true. You can get a car decal, too, with the Trek FM logo.
I want to get one of those.
Yeah, me too.
There's a lot of stuff on there that you can get. Check it out for yourself. Go to trekfm.link/trekfmstore. You can even get a shirt with an Enterprise on it, an Enterprise word cloud, and it says commentary Trek Stars in there.
It does, right in the saucer section.
And I'm trying super hard to get Aaron to make a Citizen Kane of Star Trek shirt. So if that's something that you want, let us know.
Please let us know.
Demand it so that I can get it for myself, because that's all that matters. All right. So, yeah, if you want to check that out, go to trekfm.link/trekfmstore, and that'll take you to the website. Good stuff. Just in time for Christmas.
Yeah.
Another way that you can help us out is by becoming a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at trekfm. You can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And Facebook is also where you can find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. You can find me on another podcast called Words with Nerds. And you can actually find me writing the occasional review on a site called Showvote, where I'm doing the Star Wars Rebels Season 2. And also, this weekend, we'll be releasing a retrospective on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and its place in the American humor, the halls of American humor.
Cool. I've never seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
What?
I know.
What?
Okay? Look,
come
there's
on.
A lot of movies that
no.
I haven't seen.
No, this is worse than not seeing Tombstone.
I imagine that's accurate.
It's the Citizen Kane of John Hughes movies.
Really?
Yes. This is John Hughes' finest hour, John Candy's finest hour, Steve Martin's best film performance. Not a bad note, not a sour line in the entire thing.
It's better than
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and it's an actual Thanksgiving movie. You can actually watch it on Thanksgiving weekend. It's not a holiday ahead or anything like that. It's a wonderful film.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are definitely some good Thanksgiving movies out there. I hear that this one is a quality one.
Rocky is a Rocky Thanksgiving movie.
Starts Thanksgiving. By the way, yeah. I've found this out. Rocky, the very first scene, first thing you see on screen, November 25th, 1970. That's 40 years to the day before the release of Creed.
Yeah. That can't be an accident. You know they did it on purpose.
Maybe. Rocky is a Thanksgiving movie for sure. To me, my two favorites, number two is Zach and Miri. I have not seen that. Oh, it's really good.
You know how I feel about Kevin Smith, Mike.
It's definitely one of his lesser works. You know, you kind of feel like he's just basically just making a comedy for comedy's sake, even though it is really sort of all about the making of Clerks, which is kind of cool. And this same theme that we keep on talking about, like, you know, living up to your full potential, following your dreams, you know, going out and doing something. So that's my number two. My number one is Contagion by Steven Soderbergh.
I've never seen Contagion.
Oh, it's awesome.
But you know what my number one is?
What's that?
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is, but my number two is actually Predator 2.
Oh, that's a Thanksgiving movie?
No, it has nothing to do with Thanksgiving except for when it was released.
It was released on Thanksgiving?
Yes. I recount the whole story on the Words with Nerds annual Thanksgiving celebration of giving thanks as to why it's a Thanksgiving movie for me.
Which you can find right now, right?
Yes, that's right. It's excellent. Out there. Go and excellent. Listen.
Well, if you're looking for me, you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit for like 3 more weeks. And then you can find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Trackstar Babies. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. You can find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars. And you can email us if you want to contact us directly at ComTrackStars@gmail.com.
And I don't want to let you off the hook, but for Standard Orbit, you guys are going out guns blazing, man. The recent one about Phase 2, wow. Like, seriously, you guys are just all cylinders. You have got this. If anybody has not taken the time to listen to this farewell tour for Standard Orbit, I guess, for the original hosts of Standard Orbit, you got to get out there. You got to listen to it. The Phase 2 one is just so cool. Cool to listen to.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for listening. Yeah, that was sort of the goal. We were like, let's just do it all. I still want, I don't know how it's going to work out. We have to figure this out. We got like 3 weeks to figure it out. But we do want to pull a millennium on Norm and Jeff, where we end it with basically making it such that there's no way to continue the show after we leave. And have them try to figure out, have them pick up the pieces and be like, well, I don't know how we're going to do an original series podcast anymore because now there's no more original series. You know? Like, they're literally, they somehow wiped it out of existence. How are we going to do this? You know? But we have to figure out how that is going
to
work.
I look forward to that.
If you have any ideas, you know, let me know. Send me a note on Twitter or something.
As I slip into my turkey coma, I will I'll put on my thinking cap.
All right. So, yeah, that's where you can find me. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our other shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. John, what book do you have for us this week?
Well, you know, I thought it would be fun, since there is no novelization that I know of for Run, Fat Boy, Run, since everybody should be, prepping, getting the right frame of mind for Star Trek Beyond. I think that people should amble on over to Audible and listen to the adaptation of Star Trek Into Darkness, written by Alan Dean Foster and narrated by Alice Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Pioneering director J.J. Abrams has delivered an explosive action thriller that takes Star Trek into darkness. When the crew of the Enterprise is called back home, they find an unstoppable force of terror from within their own organization has detonated the fleet and everything it stands for, leaving our world in a state of crisis. So you can go, you can listen to it.
No, you got to finish it.
Oh, okay, all right. With a personal score to settle, Captain Kirk leads a manhunt into a war zone world to capture a one-man weapon of mass destruction. As our heroes are propelled into an epic chess game of life and death, love will be challenged, friendships will be torn apart, and sacrifices must be made for the only family Kirk has left, his crew.
Thank you. Yes.
Sorry.
We've decided to read that description for the remainder of Standard Orbit because it's the best ever. It's taken from the initial plot synopsis.
Yeah.
And it makes no sense whatsoever. It's the best. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. All right. Well, that is it for Run, Fat Boy, Run. And next week, we will be back to look at Simon Pegg's fourth movie, one which he wrote with his good friend Nick Frost, and that is Paul.